Thank you, Alberto. How many of you guys have heard of small error estimation, that term? Okay, and how many of you have tried it or done it before in a study? Very good. Okay. So I tried to make the presentation today somewhat like a training, too, because I know a lot of people may not have heard of that before and may be interested in knowing how they could do something like this in their own study with their own topic of interest. Might it be cancer risk? It could be obesity, any type of outcome that you're interested in. So hopefully my presentation will be a little bit of informative for you. And if you'd like more details, of course, I'm willing to provide you with information and we can talk after the presentation. Okay, before I get started, I just want to acknowledge my research team who helped me do this work. This was part of my dissertation and is currently in clearance at the CDC. I do have some people who collaborated with me who work at the CDC, so it has to go through a clearance period before it can be published. I want to also acknowledge my funding, which was both through the National Cancer Institute at the pre- and postdoctoral levels. And just state that there are no conflicts of interest to report and that these findings do not necessarily represent the views of NIH, NCI, or the CDC. So as all of you know, this is a bad economic time in the U.S., and our government is stretched very thin with their dollars. And that's at the federal, state, and local level. There's layoffs, there's cuts in grant funding, as all of you know, and it's more and more important now more than ever to know how to allocate our resources most effectively in the most cost-effective way. And so small area estimation, in my opinion, is one way that we can learn how can we target our money and our resources to the places that need it most on a local level. It's important for developing policies and also for when we're thinking about health equity, which is a major theme of this particular meeting. It's really important because we can know which areas in our country and in your state have particular unmet needs or on the opposite spectrum have too much of a particular problem or disease. So this is a really good way for us to identify what those areas are. As most of you know who've tried to get access to local data, however, there's a lot of problems in accessing it. There are technical barriers, institutional barriers, there's a lot of regulations with HIPAA, especially if you're trying to get any geographic data. I have gone through this myself and been behind that phone talking to people trying to get access to it and face these barriers. And as a result, I learned about this method and its valuableness for getting at the answers that we want at the local level. Of course, there's limitations, but nonetheless, it is a way for us to get a starting point at looking at local level data that may not be available because of these burdens or because of administrative problems. You simply just don't, if you live in a small area, your health department may not even collect data that you're interested in at that geographic level. So this is a way that we can get it. It's increasingly in demand by both private and public sectors, and thus I think that this is a good method for epidemiologists, health service researchers, biostatisticians to know how to do. So statistically, if we can make the assumption that patterns exhibited at a large level, let's say the state level, can hold across smaller levels, let's say counties, then you can predict that information for a small level using information from a larger level. This is called indirect estimation or small area estimation. And this is just a definition from a book, sort of the seminal text in the field, that will describe to you what I just said in a more complete way. Now, of course, the state isn't going to have the exact same characteristics as the small area you're interested in looking at, but it may still have the same set of predictors, and that's really what we're talking about. Not characteristics, but more predictors and patterns, whether those can hold across areas. So indirect or synthetic estimation is often model-based, and that means that regression models are used to derive the small area estimates. So unlike back in the 60s, 70s, you read that small area estimation literature, very rarely were regression models used. And maybe at the census, the U.S. Census Bureau was kind of one of the first people to pioneer that track, where they started using models to help make their small area estimates. Now you can see it coming into the health literature in a whole lot of different outcomes. And the model approaches are going to vary widely and depend on a lot of factors, but they can include things like spatiotemporal information, random effects, and multi-level modeling. They can have prior distributions for people who are interested in Bayesian modeling, which is not my thing. Don't even ask any questions about it because I don't know. But there are a lot of people who do that in small area estimation work, so it is common. And you can also think about whether you would want to model your outcome at the individual or area level. Because you can look at things, okay, I don't want to go into that. That's a long story. Okay, sorry, let's move on. Okay, so model-based small estimation, like I said, has been applied to a lot of different outcomes. I've listed a few here, such as smoking and obesity. And the definition for a small area is not only county or only census tract. It really can be anything. Small areas are any geographic unit whose sample size is insufficient to support direct estimation. So if you were to go online and download the National Health Interview Survey and try to create a prevalence estimate for a census tract, I can pretty much guarantee you it's not going to work because you don't have enough people sampled. The survey is not powered to do that. So different studies say different numbers, but basically the sample size you would need to create a stable estimate would be somewhere between 30 and 50. That's the minimum, according to the government reports. So when are these studies really appropriate? Well, privacy protections, if they prohibited the access to geographic identifiers in your data, so basically you have de-identified data, or your data weren't collected at the geographic unit you're interested in. So what we've done is we've applied those principles to the examination of HPV vaccine coverage, which is definitely was a hot topic a few years ago, maybe not so much now, but still we don't know enough about how people are using this vaccine at a local level. The best that we can do is tell you at a state level how many people took this vaccine. But we don't really know within a state how coverage is distributed, and so that's what we wanted to look at here. There have been a few studies that have noted variation across states and counties. Both of these, by the way, are in adolescents. Nobody's been looking at the young adult population, 18 to 26, that I know of. Correct me if I'm wrong. So really, we have a long way to go in terms of looking at variation geographically in this population. And even in the adolescent population, there's very few studies that have been done, particularly multi-level studies that look at more than just individual level predictors. So we're going to try to describe the geographic distribution of HPV vaccine coverage among this older age group of women in Texas using multi-level small area estimation. In doing so, we will be the first group that has provided county-level HPV vaccine coverage estimates for an entire state. There have been some research groups that have made smaller studies and been able to provide county-level estimates for a few counties in the study region that they're looking at, but not for a whole state. Okay, so this is just a general overview of our data collection, management, and analysis strategy. And the reason that I've made this somewhat vague is because I wanted it to apply to any study that you did that was multi-level small area estimation. So I'll go through each step and tell you what we did, but I wanted our overview to be more of a way for you to see how you could do this yourself and whatever outcome you're interested in. And as you can see, to do multi-level small area estimation, you have to have multiple data sets. Obviously, the word multi-level implies that you're going to need data at more than just individual level. You're going to need group-level predictors as well. So that's why, can I get this? Oh, yeah, okay. So you have an individual data set, which is where your outcome of interest is probably going to be. In our case, it was vaccinated or not. So that was an individual level logistic binary type variable. Your group data set is going to contain covariates that you've obtained from multiple sources. They might be things like the incidence rate of a certain type of disease in a county, or the poverty rate that you can obtain from the U.S. Census. It could be a multitude of things, anything that you think has a plausible relationship with your outcome. And then you have the auxiliary data set, which is what serves as the foundation for being able to predict the outcome for units that were not sampled in this individual data set. So, you know, you don't have data on every single person in every county. You don't have data on many counties. She'll probably have 50% or more of the counties, depending on your state, with nobody in them in a national population-based survey. So that being said, you're going to need the population counts from the U.S. Census or a similar source to tell you what is the estimate for who lives in that county. What are these people like? So we need to know how many people of a particular race, age group are in that county, because that's who you're going to be making the prediction for. So that's sort of the data collection part. Data management, obviously, a lot of linkage is important. You're going to need to do data reduction or aggregation depending on how many variables you have, and that's very study specific, so it really depends on what you have. Once you've got all this data collected and gathered, you will build your multi-level model until you find the best fit and transfer the parameters. So when I say parameters, I mean the regression coefficients and their standard errors over into the prediction. Now you can do simple prediction, like you all learn in school how to put in variables and make a prediction, or you can use simulation. And for the purpose of our study, we did use simulation because personally I think that it is more appropriate because we know that parameters do exhibit variation. You run a model more than once, you will get different results. So, it especially a multi-level model that has random effects. So it builds that uncertainty into the model, and I'll describe that more in a second. Sorry, I forgot about the circles. Okay, so the individual level data set that we used was the 2008 Texas BRFSS, limited to ages 18 to 26 women, with a valid county of residence listed in the public use data set, and who reported the following variables I have listed. They had to report these variables because we use them as predictors. So if they didn't report them, they can't be in our model. And the reason that they had to have a valid county of residence is because that is a level in our model. And we can't put someone in our model who we don't know which county they are in, and thus they can't be assigned to that particular level. So for us, the sample size was 277, which isn't great, but it's good enough to be able to do the modeling. And this is just examples of what these data sets look like. Some of you are probably saying, this is simple, we know what this looks like. But for those of you who want to see an example of what a data set would look like, this is that. Have some water? Thank you. My kids are talking really fast. I'm sorry if I do that. Okay. So auxiliary data set, you'll notice it doesn't have an outcome. That's because this is not an individual level data set. Each row represents a specific type of person. So in Bell County, public health region number 9, a person who's 18 and white. How many people in that county of those demographic groups are actually living there? 839. So it's not a person, it's a type of person, if that makes sense. Okay, group level data set, that's pretty self-explanatory. You can get these data from a variety of public use sources like the U.S. Census. They'll provide things like poverty rates and health insurance rates, things like that. Okay, we merge in that data with the individual level data set and with the auxiliary data set. And the reason that we do that is because any variables you want to include in your model have to be in both of these data sets to facilitate the prediction. You cannot have a variable in your model that is not then in your prediction model. They have to be available in both, which is why you do the linkage like I showed you in the original graphic. So we did multi-level modeling, a series of models as recommended in textbooks, with the outcome being initiation of HPV vaccine, so vaccinated or not. So this could have been 1, 2, or 3. They could have completed the dose or just began it. It doesn't matter. We incorporated sampling weights at all the levels, and scaling those weights is a whole nother methodological challenge. I'm happy to share with you how I did that at another time. It's kind of long and arduous, but it's a three-level model with public health regions being at the top level, counties at the middle, and individuals at the bottom. We included age, race, ethnicity, and education regardless of their statistical significance because we know from the literature that these have been shown to be correlates of HPV vaccination. Now, some studies will say that they're significant and others won't, but because they're significant in at least more than one article, we did include them. Now, education cannot be included in the final model, and I'll discuss the reason for that in a second, but you can adjust for the effect of education afterwards using a method created by Professor Peter Cogden. And how much time I got? Okay, we also used several group level covariates, and what we did for that was we did separate principal components analysis on related covariate sets so that we would have one variable that represented each of the themes that we were looking at, like access. So we'd have one variable for that and one variable for poverty and things like that. I have a list of those I can provide you afterwards if you're interested. But we looked at a lot of different group level covariates, which is why I don't list them all here. As I said earlier, only variables that are available in both your individual level and your auxiliary data set can be used to create your prediction. So if you don't have that, like in the case of education, we had education in the individual level model. It's an important predictor of HPV vaccination, so we want to include it, right? Well, we don't have it in the auxiliary data set, so what do? Well, Peter Cogden created a way to do post-adjustment. Here's a fancy formula to do that. But basically, all it is a weighted total of the regression coefficients for education. So it's adjusting for the educational mix of that county that we're modeling for. I wouldn't do that for more than one or two variables because it does change your estimates if you make this adjustment. So the more variables you do these adjustments for, the more off your estimates are going to become. Also, you can only obtain random effect estimates for the counties that you have. So what we did is applied the mean for the sampled counties for those that weren't sampled in the BRFSS so that we would have a value for them. This describes the reason that we did the simulation. It's probably not that important. I want to get to the results. Here's the results of the multi-level model, the parameters that were significant in the different models. You'll see right here we had to take education out of the final model for the reasons I just discussed. You'll notice that at the county and public health region level, uninsurance was significantly and inversely related to vaccination. So areas that had more uninsurance had less vaccination, which makes sense because this is a population that cannot get their vaccine for free through the Vaccines for Children program. They're older. The only way they can get their vaccine for free is if their insurance covers it, so they have to be insured, or they have to know about things like Merck has a patient assistance program where they can apply for benefits and that kind of thing, but it's not easy. So uninsurance obviously is going to make a difference, and it does. Age and Hispanic ethnicity were also related to vaccination. So here's some cool little maps showing what the small area estimates look like at the county level. They range from about 2% to 24%, so we have quite a bit of variation. And you'll notice that vaccination was particularly good in the north and eastern part of the state, and particularly bad along the border and panhandle. So that's largely, you can see that these results are dependent on our model. And in our model, I just showed you that uninsurance is related to vaccination. So these areas along the border that have high rates of uninsurance, it's going to contribute to the reason that they have low vaccination according to our model. And this just shows you the difference from the state average, which was 12% for this age group. So the areas in red are further in the negative direction from the state average, and those that are blue are better than the state average. The county with the worst coverage was Webb County, which is where Laredo is located, and the best was near Houston in Orange County, where Beaumont is located, if you know anything about Texas. Okay, so in summary, we created a modeling framework that we believe is easily adaptable to other health outcomes in geographic units. It incorporates the collection and linkage of data from multiple sources, which is not an easy task, but it can be done. Inclusion of appropriate sampling weights, because it's not appropriate to simply plug in the weight that comes with BRFSS in a multi-level model. You have to scale it to the level at which you're modeling. We included random effects and we used simulation to account for the precision of the model parameters, so it's more accurate than if we were to do a simple prediction without simulation. There are some limitations of small area estimation. I've listed some here. Some of the most important are that these estimates are dependent upon the model that you build. So if the model is improperly specified, if the model leaves out variables that are important, it's going to affect your estimates in the end. So that's really important to know. There's not really a gold standard in a lot of cases for looking at how accurate these are. So it makes it a little difficult for policymakers to swallow sometimes because they don't know how accurate these estimates are. It's much better when you have at least some counties that have a benchmark so that you can look and see, okay, well, let's say Houston, you know, Harris County has a good health department, so maybe they have the resources to do a survey to find out this in their area, and then we can compare our estimates to theirs. So it's really good if you at least have some counties to compare against, which in our case was limited. So additional studies that we would like to do is looking at other modeling approaches, because we know that, like I said, your estimates are model dependent. So if you have different types of models, it's going to affect your result ultimately. We would like to look at coverage in young men, and we'd also like to assist in the development of looking at how interventions can be tailored geographically based on the results of these type of studies. So I'd be happy to take any questions that you might have at this time. Yes?
Do you know if there are any county-level media campaigns to try and promote HPV vaccination?
That's a great question. And I don't have that data. I think that intuitively it makes sense that if we had information on where these campaigns were taking place, if they are, we could look at that. But there is some literature that kind of says be wary of looking at these estimates in an evaluation type purpose, you know, and saying, well, there's a media campaign here and they have low coverage, so thus it must be the media campaign. You know, it's kind of not media campaign, but any type of intervention. It's kind of difficult to make a jump and say that it's because of the intervention that the rate is what it is. However, if we had a more representative sample, if we really knew, was there any campaign going on in this area, yes, no, that could be a variable in the model, and that would be great to have, but we didn't have it. Other questions? Okay, thank you.